Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. So good to see everybody here on a hot summer day in the winter in California. Crazy weather, huh? For those of you online, it's been 90 degrees, and I'll take that over 20 degrees in Montana. So it's not exactly pleasant, but if we think about it in context, I'd rather be hot than freezing. So welcome, everybody. Thank you to everyone who brings treats. Lots of times, treats get brought halfway through class, so if you've had your fill and you think there's nothing else back there, oftentimes there's more in the middle of class, so check it out. Well, we have a very unique situation this morning. I've been involved with Paradox class since the last millennium, about 98 or 99. And this is the very first time that Dr. Hugh Ross is with us, but isn't going to be teaching. He wants to introduce the person that is going to be teaching. So this is a very, very special moment. So, like I always ask you to do, please welcome Dr. Hugh Ross for a special announcement.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce Steve Rogstad. He's going to be speaking on living the gospel in STEM and 32 years of working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Well, let me give you a brief bio on Steve. He was raised by a Caltech astronomer father who inspired him to pursue a career in STEM. That stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In the 1990s, he graduated from Cal Poly Pomona with his bachelor and master's degree in electrical engineering, and after briefly teaching math at Maranatha High School, was able to attain a position at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he's worked as an engineer and supervisor for almost 32 years. Steve has had the privilege of directly supporting missions, such as the Mars Science Laboratory and Mars 2020 rovers, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, New Horizons Pluto Charon, and most recently, the Dragonfly mission to Saturn's moon Titan. Steve has regularly attended Christ Church Sierra Madre for the last 22 years, having attended there in his childhood. He lives in Monrovia with his wife Eileen and three children, Megan, Heidi, and Josh. And I met Steve when he had just turned 5 years of age. I met him while watching him petting his dog, Chip. I could tell that he and Chip really liked one another. But he mentions his dad here. And when I arrived at Caltech in 1973, I met his dad, Dave Rogstad. And Dave was the first serious Christian I'd met. I'd literally been a Christian for 9 years without being able to meet a serious Christian. And it was thanks to his dad that he got me over my aversion to church. All the churches I tried in Canada were either filled with people where nobody believed the Bible was the Word of God, including the pastors, or they're really excited about the Word of God, but they were a cult. But Dave was the one that convinced me, hey, the United States is different. And he gave me a list of 6 Bible-believing churches within a 6-mile radius at Caltech. That's how I wound up here at the church. So with that, I'd like to bring Steve up here to speak. And by the way, he'll be taking questions after his talk is over. Steve.
Great to be here. I probably should have done this a long time ago, but I've been involved kind of on and off in the class for, I think it's been like 15 years. But actually, so just to give you kind of the foundation, I grew up, you know, with a Caltech physicist, and I was influenced by one. I don't consider myself necessarily a real deep intellectual. I'm more of a hands-on engineer. You know, I'm good with my hands. I'm good with getting projects done. So it's been a struggle for me to share my faith at work. It's something that's difficult to do, and I'll tell you and talk you through that kind of that journey that I went through. So this is the roadmap I'm going to take us through today. A little bit about my background, how I got to JPL, what I do there. I'll share with you some of the technology I work on. and then just talk about the JPL environment. What's it like there? What's it like to be a Christian at a place like JPL? And how I initially approached witnessing for Jesus at JPL, and then what I learned over the years and how I've changed. So I want to start with the background, and as Hugh mentioned, a huge inspiration and influence in my life was my dad, Dave Rogstad. He passed away about 3 years ago, but he was a physicist at Caltech, and then he moved to JPL, where he led a team of engineers for many years, and it was his influence that really inspired me to choose to go into a STEM field at a very young age. And in my family, we were very driven. Success, you know, accomplishing things in everything, not just in science and in everything we did, but in our faith too, trying to be the best Christians we could be. But I always struggled with sin and with for God's favor. That's always been a theme in my life, something I've always struggled with and had doubts about. And so that was a challenge. A little bit about my path working to JPL. So as the bio mentioned, Cal Poly Pomona, electrical engineering. I wasn't, my older brother and I, we're Cal Poly graduates, not quite up to Caltech, but Cal Poly is a very hands-on school. Lots of practical engineering experience, and that was really a good fit for me. And there's a lot of people at JPL that have degrees from Cal Poly. So I actually, I taught at Maranatha High. I couldn't get a job when I first came out in the early 90s of school. But then I finally met someone who was going to graduate school with me at Cal Poly who worked at JPL and knew my dad, but it was in a different department. And at JPL, they're very sensitive to nepotism. You know, they don't want you, you know, your dad getting you a job too easily. So it was kind of a roundabout path. And I worked in a different department and got in kind of like a lab technician. But then my dad, after he retired, I was able to move into the area that was more what he had been doing and what I had studied in school, which was signal processing communications in that area. So later in life, my dad actually came back and worked for JPL as a retired person. And he had been the founder of a certain technology that was very important to us, which I'll be talking about in a little bit. And I got to work with him. So he ended up being there for like 20 years, only working a day a week or so. But it was fun to work with my dad. And at one point, I was sort of unofficially his boss. I was the leader of the project, and he was one of the consultants on it. So just a really good time. I enjoyed it a lot. So the Owens Valley Radio Observatory was kind of one of the key sort of places in Hugh's life and in my dad's life and in my life. This was the place, as you see in that picture there, there's me at age 3 with my dad in the winter, and the background is the 90-foot dish, and this is the time about when I decided I was going to go into STEM, was at age 3. So I think I might have beat Hugh by a few years. You don't outdo Hugh in many areas. This is one area where I beat him by a few years. I chose my career at age 3. I think for you it was age 7, right, Hugh? Yeah. And then more recently, this is showing me and my daughters on the 40-meter telescope, which is the largest aperture telescope at the Owens Valley. And at that time, I was employing an astronomer who's doing research, and she got me a tour, and I got to stand on the telescope because at that day it was being maintained and maintenance, so it was fun to do that. We were on our trip to Mammoth. So any of you who drive up the Highway 395 and you're on your way to Mammoth or somewhere else, you see just before, after you pass the town of Big Pine, you see in the desert these telescopes way out in the desert, and that's what we're talking about here. So this leads into connection to Hugh Ross, and as this book here, Always Be Ready, I love this book. I felt like I was reading my family history when Hugh and Kathy came out with this book, because as a young kid, I witnessed a lot of the events that were going on here at this time. And, you know, Hugh talks in this book about how he met my dad in the 70s, and he said 73, so that picture you see beforehand, right around there, that was about the time that my dad and Hugh were getting together and collaborating about their faith. They talk about doing door-to-door evangelism, and how my dad told Hugh, hey, you should just walk off the Caltech campus, which he meant figuratively, but Hugh took it literally and actually walked just north of the campus and started the door-to-door evangelism. And that was something they did in the New Believers Bible Study they started at this church. And there were some funny stories about that. Hugh was a pretty hardcore evangelist. And I think one of the questions on a survey used to hand to people, I believe, was something like, have you repented of your rebellion against God? So that was one of the questions. And there were people who didn't take kindly to that, so they'd slam the door in Hugh's face. And one of our mutual friends, Wayne Atkins, told the story that as they were walking away from that encounter, Hugh would say, I could see the conviction in their eyes. So undaunted evangelism, and that's not me. That's not something I do. And so just appreciating that boldness. So, you know, you guys are familiar with the story and in details in this book about Hugh becoming a minister of evangelism at the church and the Paradoxes class starting, of course. Some of you, you know, have maybe were around during that time. And then starting the ministry, RTB, the church, leadership encouraged Hugh to start the ministry. So just how important there was the church and all of that collaboration going on and the Lord using that. And my dad actually started working for RTB after he retired from JPL. So he started working for them, and he did until he passed. And he also worked at JPL, so sort of part-time for each. So I'm going to move now into tell you what I do at JPL. So I work for what's called the Deep Space Network. That's primarily the project that I work for and develop systems for. So the DSN is special because it's got three complexes around the Earth, roughly 120 degrees separation. So at all times, as the Earth's rotating, it's able to see what it's tracking. There's never a time when it's not, you know, connected. It's pretty much a 360-degree, 24/7 view of whatever spacecraft or source the DSN is tracking. And there's big telescopes there, even larger than the ones at OVRO. There's some that are 230 foot wide, the 70 meter, and then there's four, typically five antennas at each place, and the 34 meter, 116 feet. This is typically for communication to the moon and beyond. And we, in my group, we develop receivers for the DSN and antenna combiners. So let me just show you what that is. These are some radio receivers, some examples. This one on the left there, that's the old reel-to-reel tapes you probably see in old cheesy science movies where, you know, it's supposed to make it look modern, but now it looks really dated. And Hugh can remember using those old tapes. Some of those tape drives, you know, at the time was a huge amount of data. I think some of those tapes had like a terabyte of data on them, which at the time in the 70s was a massive amount of storage. But now, you know, as we've moved on and we're now using commercial hardware, it already comes and then you just put your hardware and software on it, and now 16 terabytes in a small solid state drive and a lot faster. And actually, I just had a class for the one on the bottom. It's called a software-defined radio. That's kind of the next generation. And that's where everything's, the hardware is ready for you. The software has kind of got little compartments for you to put your code in. And so it's getting a lot easier and a lot more powerful as time goes on. There's kind of three areas we work on at JPL in my department, and three key things that people like Dave and like Hugh and my dad were the founders of in their radio astronomy. One of them is called VLBI, or very long baseline interferometry. And so at JPL, we use this technique because it allows us to track the spacecraft to extremely fine precision. So we have a technique called delta door differential one-way ranging. That allows you to have two telescopes looking at a spacecraft, then looking at a quasar, which is a natural radio source, and you know, I'll show you a picture of that. Here's a quasar. It's a black hole that's, material swirling. It's shooting off jets of stuff that reaches the Earth billions of years later, and it's an extremely fine point in space that never moves. And you can use it kind of like a reference point, something you can compare your spacecraft to so you know exactly where it is. And that allows you to track the spacecraft and land on a planet with really good precision. We're talking meters of precision now. You can essentially land on a dime on Mars, whereas in the past, you know, you didn't want to land just anywhere. You had to land in a huge open field where there weren't any rocks. Now you can pinpoint and land right where you want to, the interesting place where all the science is. And then we also have something that we use when we land a spacecraft, entry, descent, and landing. That's when a JPL spacecraft is landing on a planet, the spacecraft sends out tones, and there you can detect those, even though it's a lot of stuff going on when it's landing, and we use our receivers to detect those tones. So here's a picture of what's going on in the Mars situation. You see these big circles, they keep getting narrower and narrower as the technique gets better, and as every spacecraft we land, you keep getting more and more accurate until you see this little point in the middle there, and that's, now we can land on Mars to within a few tens of meters of accuracy because of this Delta Door technique, because quasars are such a precisely fixed point in space. And landing on, you guys may have seen the Mars landing on TV, and every stage that it's going through, it sends out a tone, kind of like on a piano. You know, middle C means it's the spacecraft's parachute's opening. So you agree beforehand, that note means this is happening. And so it's an easy way to communicate and find out what's going on, even though, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening. It's decelerating. It's hard to hear the radio signal, but you can hear these tones. And kind of the future mission that I've been funded for is the Dragonfly mission, an exciting mission that they're going to land a quadcopter on Titan, the moon of Saturn, which is the size of a small car. And this is an interesting place because, for one thing, it's a big moon. It's got an atmosphere that's 1.5 times as thick as Earth's atmosphere. It's got liquid lakes and rivers and rain happening on it. And it's not water. It's methane. It's liquid methane. It's so cold there that methane actually turns to liquid. So it's going to be really fascinating being part of, listening to the tones as it's landing and watching it fly around Titan and getting some interesting pictures. So really excited to be a part of that mission. So the last area we're involved in is antenna combining. So we've got these big antennas, and some spacecraft are so far away that we need to join a lot of antennas together in order to see a good signal. And actually, my dad literally wrote the textbook, Antenna Arraying in the Deep Space Network. You can get this on Amazon. It's translated into Chinese. And this is kind of the founding text for our... I used it a few weeks ago. I had to figure something out because we're doing a new delivery of the array. So Voyager was recently, this picture here, Voyager recently had a problem. It switched from an X-band signal to an S-band signal. This was just a few months ago. And they couldn't detect the data. And so we had to put 6 antennas on it in order to detect it. And that was able to switch it back. Here's pictures of Voyager. Voyager is way out past the sun's influence. It's out in interstellar space, flying around with the Starship Enterprise. So it's way out there. And the Pluto encounter used our array, too, because as they were flying by Pluto, they needed to be able to get their data back quickly. And this is to give you an idea of what the Voyager data rate is. Really slow. If some of you guys remember using these old modems, the 300 bit per second, where you could see text scrolling like across the screen, this is the data rate that Voyager is transmitting now. Voyager is one light day away from Earth, and it took 50 years to get there. Gives you an idea of how huge the distances between stars are. 50 years, a spacecraft traveling at 37,000 miles an hour, and it only gets one light day away. And so it just shows you how huge the universe is. So I'm going to switch gears now and talk about the JPL environment. JPL is a great place to work. People work there for decades, and I'm no exception. And I'm certainly not the longest career. The longest career is actually this person, Sue Finley. She works in my group. I work with her every day. She's got a book written about her called Rise of the Rocket Girl. Some of you may have seen that. And she's been in the group. She loves her job. She has no plans to retire. I think she turns 89 this year. So people love their work at JPL. Very pleasant place to work. And as Hughes shared even recently, people tend to be at Caltech and JPL very engrossed in their research, in their work. They don't spend a lot of time thinking about their eternal soul. They love their work. I've found that at JPL, people have a high level of integrity. And there's a lot of trust, there's good friendship there. These are good people. These aren't the people that are eager to hear about a Savior. There's very established beliefs. There's serious Christians at JPL, there's committed atheists, and there's in between, but they don't tend to change what they believe. They're pretty set in their ways. They're pretty guarded about religion. They talk about anything else, even politics. Religion is not one that they're interested in talking about if it has to do with anything personal. And the naturalistic worldview is pretty much the norm, the assumption. Whenever you talk to people, you know, that's what you're talking about. There was a flight software engineer on my floor that would walk around with a t-shirt that said, "Faith is not a reason." So I never engaged that one. I kind of wish I had. So, however, you know, so growing up, my initial witness approach was influenced, I think, by my dad and by other things I was involved in, like Campus Crusade for Christ and other organizations. I think at the time, there was more of a Christian environment in America, and it was easier to appeal to people based on the faith they'd grown up with. I remember my dad talking to Jehovah's Witnesses at the door, and his style was to, I think he was upset at them because they were, you know, walking around deceiving people, and he used to pin them down, find scriptures that contradicted what they say. And I remember one time my dad said, had pinned them down on some verse, and they didn't have an answer, and then he said to them, "You're not Jehovah's Witnesses, you're Jehovah's false witnesses." That was a pretty bold thing to say. And then he kind of chuckled and walked away. And that was, what I witnessed. I think for myself, you know, having those examples and just seeing that as needing to have all the answers, you know, not engaging people unless you have the answers, making sure you're ready and you have the answers. You don't want to be caught, you know, without the answer. There was also a pressure for me to be better than my secular colleagues, and when I mean better, I mean morally better, ethically better. I had to outdo them because I was the Christian. I had to show them what it was like to be a Christian. My style of evangelism was more confrontative. If I knew the answer and I knew I could pin them down, I'd do that. But if I didn't, I would stay away. I wouldn't talk about it because I was afraid to engage. You know, what if I was wrong? And then there's just a strong pressure to keep faith to myself. And I think that's true of a lot of Christians at JPL. You know, ones I've met, you find out about it through different things, but they're not very bold about it. There's a strong pressure to just keep it to yourself and not share it with others. I had the privilege of interacting with a strong atheist for 25 years. He's one of my closest friends, one of the best men I know, but I would consider him a Dawkins atheist. He's hardcore. He's an evangelist for the worldview. He's not afraid to challenge Christianity. And he's not overly obnoxious. I mean, he won't just share with anyone. It's when you engage him. But he has no problem eagerly challenging what he considers the fallacies of Christianity. He, at one point, wore a letter A pin, kind of in reference to Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. Instead of adulterous, he'd wear A as an atheist. He'd proudly wear this pin and say, "I'm an atheist." And he would cross out "money, in God we trust" on money, because any bill he got, he would cross out. And he kind of gave up on that. He realized the billions of bills out there, he wasn't making much of a dent. But for a time, he did that. My dad was also a good friend of his. He was a friend. His wife went to my parents' church, and they were friends, and he had grown up in a Christian family. My dad and I used to double team him at work. We'd have long discussions and get in arguments, sometimes getting mad at each other and have to apologize. And it was an interesting time. And sometimes we'd pin him down, but not very often. He was pretty smart. He usually didn't get pinned down. You know, I found that as I interacted with him over the years, his main objections weren't necessarily the scientific evidence, even though he did object to a lot of that and question it. His objections were more personal. He believed out of fear as a child. He feels that when he was a child and he received Christ, it was for fear of hell. It wasn't for love of God. And didn't feel like he got the love that he needed from his family or his father, and that had an influence on him. As a young man, he was a Christian, and he felt a lack of power to overcome struggles. There were different sins as a Christian. You know, you have a standard, and you want to do the right thing, but he felt like he didn't have the power to do that. Even when he prayed, it wasn't there. He felt that Christians were a poor example of the Christian life and used that as an excuse for why Christianity isn't something you should follow. Look at the Christians. There's so many that are hypocrites that don't live the right life. And I think he objected what he claimed is the arrogance of that we have all the answers, we know all the answers, and we've got all the right things to say. You know, I argued with him, but I couldn't dismiss all these things. Some of them are true. And then in my own life, I had trials, things that were hard to deal with. And of course, Jesus promises us trials, right? He's mentioned that recently, how Jesus says, in this world you will have tribulation, or you can say, in this world you'll have thermodynamics, right? This world is designed, God designed it for us to go through some trials because it changes us and it works on us. But it doesn't always feel that way, right? Sometimes it feels like God's not there. I went through a period of time where I had cancer. I had a small mole on my leg. It turned out it was the most dangerous form of melanoma cancer you could get. And it grew into my leg, and it was getting into my lymph nodes, and I had to have 11 lymph nodes removed from my left leg. So I permanently have a swollen leg here. Luckily, it's not that bad, and it's under control. 2 years later, I had to have open heart surgery. I had a congenital heart valve issue, and it finally came and was a problem, and I had to have open heart surgery. And being sandwiched between cancer and heart surgery is a brutal thing, I'll tell you, because you're going through cancer treatment, you're having scans, I don't know if I can have the heart surgery because what if I have cancer? I kind of have to wait. And there's just this uncertainty in period. And that was a hard time where I wanted to feel, take my anxiety to go away, but it wouldn't. It was with me, and I felt like God wasn't taking it away. Where was God? But I'll tell you, the cancer and heart surgery weren't as bad as becoming the group soup at JPL. That was worse than anything. I was, an engineer. I enjoyed my little work, and I didn't want to lead others. And then just before I went into heart surgery, the group supervisor told me, I'm leaving, and you're the best person for this job. And I didn't want to admit, but really I was in a position where it would have been the best for the group for me to take the position, and I didn't want it. And then there was this huge project. We were actually building a big new version of the array technology I told you about. And that was a big project, lots of money, very stressful. So I came out of heart surgery, back to work, and immediately became the supervisor and the project manager for that. And it was just so stressful. I was so stressed, and I felt such a weight on me. And I was like, God, where are you? Why did you allow this? Why do I have to go through this? And even recently, just in my family, some of the ways I was raised and some of the, things that I put on my kids and on my wife to be a certain way, I've had to learn, that I need to let go. And so those things have been very difficult, and we've gone through some times of struggle, and God's working in our lives. But all these things together, and just realizing that a lot of my colleagues at JPL seem like they're better than me. They're more righteous than me. They're less angry, less stressed. They handle people better. How can I be a witness for Christ when they're better than I am? So for the last part of this, I want to tell you the process I went through, how I grew and I learned to be better and to shine for Christ. So first of all, preparing with good answers, letting my light shine, walking in the light, and practicing genuine love. So first of all, that's what this class is about, right? Preparing good answers. What a great thing. And the theme verse, I think, is 1 Peter 3:15. But in your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason or the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. What a great theme verse for this class and for Hugh's book, Always Be Ready, and for this talk. And that's the key, right? Is preparing with answers, being a student of the Bible, reading books like Hugh's book. I've handed out Why the Universe is the Way It Is. That's a book I really like. I've handed that out to colleagues from time to time. Kind of a comprehensive view of why God created the universe and why it is the way it is in a form that's easy to understand. In this class, we've practiced this debating. We've practiced sharing our faith, even within a 30-second window, I know. Being able to just practicing and being able to share, why do you believe? And having that as a discipline in your life. Praying for opportunities with colleagues. Praying, you know, prayer is so important. We're joining God in His plan, and we're joining Him and discussing it with Him, and He's opening our mind to these possibilities, you know. And so praying for opportunities with colleagues and being willing to engage when there's an opportunity. Taking an interest and respecting others' worldviews, even when I disagree. Sometimes it's good just to listen and not tell them what we believe. Just listen to their story. So, letting my light shine. And of course, Matthew 5:16 tells us to let our light shine before others so that they can see our good works and give glory. Most of the colleagues at JPL are not like my atheist friend. Most of them have no interest in talking about faith. If you bring it up at all, they're completely against it. They don't want anything to do with it. With those, I just open my life up. I tell them what I do. I tell them I'm a worship leader at church. I play a guitar. Sometimes I even bring the guitar into my office because it's too hot outside when I'm going to bring it to church. And I tell them about the trips I've taken to Mexico, how I've, you know, helped people. You know, it's very popular these days, you know, helpful and being charitable things. I'm open about the pros and cons of church life. You know, in churches, there's broken people. I'm one of them. A lot of times, we can, you know, those who grew up in the church can be legalistic. We can be Pharisees. We can, you know, act a certain way, like we have all the answers, we know everything, when in our hearts we're broken. Acknowledging that. Engaging with their experiences. A lot of atheists have been hurt in the past. They grew up in the church. They experienced things that hurt them, and they've turned against it. To listen to that and to acknowledge it is important. I had the privilege of inviting a lot of my colleagues to my dad's memorial service. Since he had worked among them, they had an affection for him. And at our service, Hugh and Kathy spoke, and my brothers and sisters spoke, and we talked about my dad and the good and the bad and just how God used it all. And I also, if I can't tell my colleagues anything, I just tell them I'm a follower of Jesus. I'm compelled by Jesus. So walking in the light, that's a little more painful. That's admitting my faults and asking forgiveness when I'm wrong. You know, I might not be as nice as my colleagues. I might be more sinful and less righteous, but one thing I can do is when I'm wrong, I can admit it and ask their forgiveness. That's a powerful testimony, something you can do, even if you're not as nice as they are. I also like to express gratefulness to them for their good character and integrity. Some of these men, including the one I talked about and others, have been key people in my life. They've blessed me. God's used them to bless me in so many ways. And just thanking them for that, for their character and their integrity and their good friendship. I admit to them I have doubts sometimes about my faith. I don't always have the answers. You know, when I was going through cancer, I can't say I felt close to God all the time. I struggled. I open up about my greatest fears and trials. I've shared with them about things I've gone through in my marriage. I've shared with them, you know, everything. I just open up because I want them to see someone genuine. I want them to know that if they're in trouble, that the Lord is there, and just expressing the hope I have in Jesus to them. So I want to conclude by saying that kind of the bottom line in this whole thing is genuine love. Especially as a group supervisor, I think I had the opportunity to really demonstrate that to my employees. The verses that go with that, of course, having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. And then the one we all know well, Galatians 5:22, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Notice it doesn't say the fruit of the Spirit is how many people you save this week or how good or righteous you look to your coworkers. It's this peace. It's the stuff that God's doing in your own heart. That's the fruit of the Spirit. Against such things, there's no law. When you show these things and you love people, they're gonna respond to that. They're going to appreciate that. They're going to open up to you. So in conclusion, I would just say having genuine love and interest for your coworkers, employees, and managers, working for their success, they know you're for them. And this isn't just for your coworkers, this is your family too. I had to learn how to treat my family as good as I did my coworkers and my employees and my managers. So that was a lesson I had to learn because I had expectations of my family that they would be better, but I had to lay off that. And so doing that for your coworkers, your family, your friends, and then just the witness, the kind of the bottom line witness that I communicate to my colleagues is what convinces me Jesus is alive and he's working in my life today. And that's it. Thanks.
Steve, that's awesome. Thank you so much for being here. You've been a member of the class for so long, and we finally talked you into getting up there. I hope it's not the last time. I hope it's not another 15 years. So this is terrific. So the way this will work is, if you're we're live in the class or online, as long as we have questions coming from both sources, we'll take turns with those questions. And we do have one online question from somebody who cheats because they're in the class, but that's okay. It says, regarding the Dragonfly mission to Titan, would an electrical spark ignite the methane atmosphere?
No, I don't believe so. In that situation, there's not oxygen, and it does not happen. Yeah, it's in a different form.
This is great that you got to hear you speak. I don't know if you heard you speak before in front of a crowd, but I think you did a good job. I always wanted to write a book just for my own learning, and probably nobody else would read it, but I'm thinking, have you ever thought about writing a book, or have you written a book? And if you haven't written the book, why haven't you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I have inspiration to do things, and writing a book isn't necessarily one of them. It's a lot of work. I think I like to do things in smaller spurts, you know, so, but I appreciate that.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
So we live in a time right now where money is getting tighter and tighter and tighter, and what the government spends its money on is getting spread thinner and thinner with different programs. As a Christian, why do you believe it's important to continue to support the space programs?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think investing in technology is important. I think investing, first of all, there's just an excitement and a wonder that comes when you explore, right? I mean, look at when God created the universe and the world, he was excited. He said, this is good. And in the human spirit, there's this desire to create and to explore. And that's kind of what heaven's about, right? When we go to heaven, we're going to be exploring God's infinite person for all of eternity. And that's what is inside us. So I think it's important that we maintain that sense of wonder and exploration. So I feel it's very important to invest in science. And then beyond that, I think the technology is important that we invest in technology. So much of the technology we have today was spurred by the fact that we needed it for special things like space exploration. I mean, even like your cell phone, anything you can think of, that push to develop that technology is what eventually led to benefit everybody. And I think it's a big mistake and short-sighted not to invest in that. And so those are probably the two things that I would say are the key.
Thanks.
Hey, Steve, thanks for sharing. Sometimes, unfortunately, budgets get cut back. Have you any positive stories you've heard of people who have found new opportunities because maybe they were let go recently in the last few years or even before that, where they end up being in the private sector and being able to contribute with their own hard work and having learned something from working at a place like JPL, hard work and teamwork. Have you heard any interesting stories along those lines?
So your question is like, have I heard interesting stories about collaboration that's gone on at JPL? Is that what you're...
Just individuals who, although let go, end up finding a local company. And I understand it could be hard for you to run into them because if they've left and they might be in another town, but I've just been curious. Like, it's unfortunate when budgets get cut back, but sometimes there's more engineers in the workplace because of it.
Yeah, okay. So I think, So I've employed some engineers, one of which left, and he didn't get laid off, but he left JPL, and he went to work for a company in down near Huntington Beach called Anduril, a defense company. And he was a very gifted hardware firmware engineer. So he's taking his experience in JPL and he's applying it to, you know, defense and drones, which is a very important area this time. So I was very sorry to lose him, but his experience and his collaboration here is definitely benefiting people outside. And there have been people laid off at JPL, and it is infusing the workforce with, you know, people who've worked here for years. And, you know, The one story is I'm thinking of is my own employee, but yeah, I'm sure it's happening. But yeah.
Okay. Hi there. Thanks so much for your presentation. I really appreciated that. I'm not sure if I even know enough about space exploration to know how to intelligently ask this question, but I'll try. I don't know all of the reasons why we in the United States feel we need to keep exploring, going to the moon, exploring other planets, in relation to our own safety, if other nations are doing that and we are not, or I don't know what the various reasons are, basic reasons for all of that. I'm in the dark. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, like I shared before, I think it's important that we maintain, you know, a cutting edge in the United States to explore space. It feeds into so many other things. I mean, when we have, you know, the technology that you develop when you're pushing the boundary. For instance, let me give you an example. So, you know, JPL's kind of in somewhat of a crisis now because there's been big budget cuts. And one of the big missions they cut was the Mars sample return mission. And this was an expensive mission. You know, it was, so basically the idea there is we launched the Mars 2020 rover, and it landed on Mars in 2021. It's collecting a lot of samples, going around and collecting samples and putting them in little cases. And then we were gonna send another probe up to land and retrieve those samples. Now, retrieving samples and bringing them back is it's a very difficult thing. It's a lot more difficult than just sending and landing on Mars. So it's kind of another order of magnitude of funding. So instead of $1 billion or $2 billion, we're talking, you know, $10 to $20 billion of investment. But, you know, they canceled that mission, and it's too expensive. We don't have the will for it. But then, you know, there's this idea that they're going to send humans to Mars. And I'll tell you, if we're going to send humans to Mars, we definitely need to send a probe there and back first. So I think, you know, this idea that you can do things without investing the time and money and the in-between, doing the in-between work is a problem. And so I think if we're going to be leaders in space and we're going to go out and, you know, discover these things and do this amazing stuff, we need to keep investing in it and not cutting it. But, yeah. that's my opinion.
Well, that ties right into the next question. Tony Berrigan, who's usually here in class, we miss you, Tony. Hope to see you soon. He says, Steve, how many spaceships would it take to have a successful mission to Mars? I assume he means a manned mission.
Well, I mean, we've talked about that in this class, right? I think there's some fundamental physics limitations to going to Mars and things that we have to overcome before we can send humans to Mars. I personally think it's better that we send robots and we do use AI and we use technology in order to simulate the Mars environment on Earth. I think it's going to be very difficult to send humans there. I heard the budget was some on the order of $1 trillion, and that's just an initial estimate. It's going to take so much money, and is it even going to be worth it? You're going to have to get lots of governments involved. They're all going to have to invest in it. It seems too costly, and the benefit seems too low. So I think it would be a lot better to invest in artificial intelligence, in new robotic technology, in landing robots, having larger telescopes that we can see what's going on, and that's just a much better way to go. That's what I think.
Tinny W. asks, thank you for sharing your testimony about your faith at JPL. When engaging with your Dawkins-like friend of yours, do you have any tips on how to stay cool and engage discussions with a level head?
Yeah, and kind of as I shared, I think there's a level of humility required. There's times when you're talking and you just may not have the answer. And not to panic over that. I think my initial approach was to panic. You know, I'm not one who is naturally gifted at arguing and philosophy and things like that. I'm more of a hands-on engineer. It was difficult. You know, I felt threatened when someone would ask a probing question. But I think the key is to not panic in that situation, to just acknowledge, yeah, I don't have an answer for that. That's a good point. I'll go look into it. And then don't just say you're going to look into it. Really look into it. And you'll find when you look into it, usually it works in your favor. You find it's amazing what you can discover about the Christianity and how it proves to be true when you investigate it, just like Hugh's testimony. It's amazing. I was just the other day, I was on ChatGPT, and I'm just going to ask ChatGPT about Christianity. And I said, you know, which religion is the most diverse and embedded in every culture? And it said Christianity by a long shot, you know. And just knowing that Christianity is embedded in every culture, it's translatable to every culture. It's not just in one culture. Every culture has their version of Christianity, and it's the gospel. And there's differences in how we practice things and stuff, but at the bottom of it, it's Jesus saves us, and we need him. And so, just investigating a simple thing, you don't get disappointed. Those who put their trust in God are not disappointed.
And that's one of the reasons to believe, you know, that it can be relevant to every culture, I think. I don't even know how to phrase my next question, and this will be my last one. Thank you for letting me ask another one. I'm just thinking about security issues that there might be, because you guys have a lot of technological advancement that you've achieved. I'm wondering if we share this technology with any kind of protocols with particularly China. I know we do things with Russia. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, excellent question, Doug. So at JPL, yes, we do have to be careful what technology we share. So there are categories of technology, and there's a government thing called ITAR, the International Traffic, and I can't remember what the acronym stands for. It's essentially, you know, there are technologies that you're not allowed to share with foreign entities because they could be military secrets. Now the DSN, it turns out, is not in that category in most cases. Like the signals we receive from space, those are sort of public, right? Because first of all, quasars, you know, everybody can you know, see a quasar signal. Even the spacecraft downlink, you know, everyone can see that. If they have a telescope, they could intercept it. That's not so much a problem. More the issue is the uplink. So when you're commanding a spacecraft to do something, you don't want anyone getting in the way of that and telling it to do something you don't want it to do. So that's under the rules. But the stuff that I receive from Voyager, that's not as much of a problem and not as much of a security issue. Now, of course, at JPL, there's a lot of IT security issues. We've got computers. We don't want people getting access to them. So there's a lot of stuff we have to deal with in order to make sure that they're safe. And every computer, whether it's behind a firewall or two or three firewalls, has to be locked down to the very last piece of it. And so it's a lot of work. Yeah.
YG Books asks, he says, as a person with a great career and a solid foundation in Christianity, what do you see as the importance of the local church, and how have you been involved in a local church?
Yeah, good question. So I've been involved in my local church, which is this church, Christ Church Sierra Madre, for about 22 years, and I grew up in this church, as the bio said. I'm involved in the music. I'm a musician, so I've been on the worship team for a long time. I'm also involved in the Celebrate Recovery ministry, which meets in this room on Tuesdays, and I'm actually there for myself, and I also help leading worship, and I speak once in a while. And so just the local church is very important, and I know Hughes talked about our church being kind of right around the JPL and Caltech. This is a good church for STEM people to go to because there's this class. There's people here who are involved in science and math and technology who can give good answers. So this church is a vital place for people to engage with Christianity, especially those who are in the technical fields.
Can you take just a couple of minutes, because I think some people don't know where JPL is, what it even stands for? What is JPL, part of the government? Is it privately funded? What do they actually do?
Yeah, so JPL's mission is to do robotic exploration of the solar system and beyond. So, you know, we've got rovers and spacecraft flying all over the place. The DSN has to track dozens of these things. It's a lot of work. So we're the unmanned mission center. So we are sort of a NASA center, but actually we're employees of Caltech. So we're contractors. We're kind of in between. We kind of have this interesting status where we are a NASA center. We're not NASA employees. We're treated like a NASA center when we want to. We're not treated like a NASA center when we don't want to. So we have an interesting status. So JPL stands for Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and that's kind of a misnomer because we don't actually do any jet propulsion right now. That was back in the early days, back in the 30s. JPL was started as a lab by Caltech, and it was some of these crazy guys that worked at Caltech who were blowing up labs, like explosions in labs, because they were experimenting with rocket fuel, and they said, you guys, get out of here. Go to the Arroyo Riverbed, which is the riverbed, you know, it's kind of between La Cañada and Pasadena, the Arroyo Riverbed. So that's how JPL started. These crazy rocket guys went over and started experimenting there. And then they got contracts during World War II with the Army to help with jet-assisted takeoff. So they strapped rockets onto propeller planes and helped them take off faster, I think from aircraft carriers and things, so that they could take off quicker. That's where the jet propulsion came from. But we kept the name. It's hard to change a name, and it's sort of, you know, you just get it in your head and you don't even think of it. And so it just stuck, and we're still called JPL. So we're the Unmanned Spacecraft Exploration NASA Center.
It's that center of buildings that you see off to your right when you go north on the 210 heading out of Pasadena. Looks like its own little city.
That's right. Little city. It's got some satellite dishes on the top. Actually, one of the tallest buildings that has a little satellite dish on top, that's my building, the communications division. And we are responsible for communicating with the spacecraft and doing science related to antennas and stuff like that. So.
Steve, does JPL still have a yearly open house?
Yes.
When is it?
You know, I think it's typically like in the spring, and I think either the spring or the summer, and you have to get a ticket. It's so popular that you actually have to sign up for it and get a ticket. I can't remember if it's employees who hand out tickets or you go online for them, but it's a little harder to get into now because it's so popular. You know, I never went to one of those, but what I did was I always took my kids to Take Your Child to Work Day. That was kind of like the JPL open house for employees. So many years I brought my kids and they sat in my office with me and went to meetings and then they had special events for us. So that's what I did. I've never been to an open house myself. It's a little too crowded. I try to avoid it.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah.
Yes, I've been to those open houses with Boy Scouts and it's chaotic.
Yeah.
So many people. So thank you for your presentation. Never thought to ask it, but you were talking about people going to Mars and maybe it's premature if we should be sending robots first. Why don't we ever talk about inhabiting the moon?
Yeah, the moon is a lot easier to get to. So we've already sent people to the moon in the, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s. There were several of the Apollo missions that went to the moon and they stayed for a few days at most. The moon's also in not a very nice place to be. You know, the sun is very, you know, there's a lot of radiation. You're not protected by the Earth's magnetic field. There's more radiation. It's a difficult place to live. You know, there's no, they have talked about like landing on the poles and mining, you know, mining water out of some of the deep craters. So there is a plan to go to the moon, I think before Mars, and that's what the Artemis missions are doing. They're sending people to land on the moon. They want to have kind of a permanent base on the moon, and they are going to do it. Whether they stay permanently, I don't know. It might be proved too difficult, kind of like the Apollo missions, but they are doing it, and that's what the Artemis missions are for. So,
Steve, Dave Sargent, who says it's 12 degrees in Wyoming right now, he says, would the sun's lethal solar radiation kill everyone aboard a craft to Mars?
I think, you know, I know Hughes discussed that. I've read things, I've watched videos on that. I think, you know, people could probably reach Mars, but they would be in bad shape. There's radiation, it affects your digestive system. I think it's a risky move. We need to come up with technology with better shielding. And right now, the shielding that we would need is just too heavy. There's this thing called the rocket equation. You guys may have heard of that. And that's this idea that the bigger your spacecraft is and the more fuel you have, the more fuel you need to carry that. And there's this sort of this curve where you got to have a huge amount of fuel just to carry the fuel that you need. And that, I think in the case of some of this shielding, that's just out of scope. We can't do it yet. It's just, the amount of energy required would just be massive, like in some cases, more energy than we have in the whole Earth, you know, all the gas reserves on the whole Earth. So we're not there yet. Something needs to change. Something needs to give. Yes.
Hi there. I'm the wife. I just wanted to go back to the question about the benefits of continuing with space
right.
exploration and all that. And it just made me think of the fact that we have cell phones because of the satellites and all that. If we never sent those things up, we wouldn't have it. And my assumption is that, you know, like on the International Space Station and all that, they're actually doing scientific experiments, and whether it's benefiting weather or the environment, all kinds of things like that. So does that sound right? It's not just technology that's benefiting. They're doing huge amounts of research.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think any research that we do, you know, there's various things people get money for research for. I'm definitely an advocate for anything you can do that can advance our understanding, just the knowledge about the world. And of course, you know, there's different things that motivate research. And, you know, those of us who are believers, we tend to be a little more skeptical of things that point to naturalistic, you know, tendencies. Like, for instance, you know, SETI, okay, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, you know. Those of us who are believers are like, should we be spending money on all that? Because, you know, is that really what we should be spending our antenna time on? And there could be theistic implications for why we think that and not. But, you know, research that is going to benefit humanity, you know, discovering, you know, new ways to save energy, or, you know, I definitely is worthwhile. So,
Steve, every once in a while I run into people, and we probably all do, who are absolutely convinced that the whole Mars or lunar landing was a hoax. Is there a good way to answer that that's sort of common sense, has some common sense to it that everybody could understand, other than just saying, no, you're wrong? How should we answer that?
So as a communications person, of course, the evidence I have is that I've got telescopes looking at it all over the Earth, and they're all seeing the same signal. There's really no way you can fake that signal. I mean, where's the signal coming from, you know? So that's kind of my answer. But I think one of the best answers, one of the most powerful evidences that we went to the moon is that we have these corner reflectors on the moon, these laser reflectors. You can point a laser at the moon, and it'll come back to you, you know, in whatever, the 2.5 seconds, whatever the round-trip light time of the moon is. How could you do that if you hadn't put that laser reflector on the moon? Somebody went there. And, you know, there's a lot of other things, too. But those are kind of the two I can think of that really, you know, show that we've been there. There's a lot of other things you can do, too, just building a case for, you know, why, you know, in the 60s, we didn't have the technology to fake it. We didn't have the movie technology. It was a lot cheaper just to do it. And then, you know, I've seen real launches. Like, I witnessed the launch, the InSight, Mars InSight lander launch. They said, oh, in 4 a.m, just get up in your backyard and you can see this thing flying from Vandenberg. And yeah, sure enough, at 4 a.m, this thing shot off and went off into space. And I'm like, wow, you know, there really are rockets going into space. And of course, communication satellites. How is it that on our house we can point an antenna out into space and get a TV signal? Where's that coming from? It's coming from a geosynchronous satellite. How did that get there? Well, if that can go there, it's not that much harder to get to the moon. You know, there's so many things you can bring up that kind of shoot apart this idea that we faked it. So,
yeah, I guess now that I'm thinking about it, you would be in a position with your job to detect how long it takes for a signal to go to whoever's talking back, if they're just orbiting Earth and didn't really make it to the moon, that signal would be a lot quicker in its response and return, right?
Yeah, and so, yeah, what you're talking about is ranging, radial ranging, and I don't do that in my little area, but in my larger group, there's some people who do ranging. So ranging to Mars, you know, you send out a signal, and it's got some coding on it, and then you send it back and you count how many beeps it goes through, and you say, oh, the spacecraft's exactly, you know, this many meters away. And so you wouldn't be able to do that if there wasn't a spaceship out there. And, you know, another thing is, you know, when we're landing on Mars, we're also looking at Mars with telescopes, like optical telescopes. We can do that. We can see there's a storm, and then the spacecraft sees exactly the same thing. We've definitely sent things out there, you know. And, you know, people who really want to investigate it and see if it's true will find it is true. Those who just want to say, no, I don't believe it, I just don't want to. You got to investigate it. You can't just sit in your room and close your eyes, and it takes some work. You got to go and look at it, and you got to look into it. So,
another question, are your kids interested in a STEM career as well? Will this be a third-generation Caltech JPL Christian legacy?
Well, that's actually one of the topics that I talked about with my family, how I was kind of, you know, pushing them into something they didn't necessarily want to be involved in. But actually, my son, I have 3 kids, and my youngest is a 16. He's actually very smart, and he's interested in different things. At this point, he's interested in aviation, and not so much JPL, but all my kids have been to JPL. They all enjoyed it. I don't know that any of them are going to become engineers. Maybe my son will decide that that is the career for him, but right now he's not headed that way. But I've had to let go of that, and, you know, in that science, and more so in faith, I've had to let go of my kids in the way that they come to Christ. They all believe, but they're different than me. They don't practice it the same way I do. You know, they have different struggles than I did. And I've just had to let go and trust God that He's going to guide them, and I don't have to be in control of it. So,
You know, we have this unique thing that I talked about at my announcements, that Hugh Ross is in the audience, and he never is. And I'm wondering, Hugh, do you have a question for Steve? Would you like to come up? And you're good, okay. All right, we have another online question. David Jinko says, how does JPL work differ from or work with private space companies like SpaceX and others? Is there much private rover or robotics work there?
Yeah, so I think JPL is more science-oriented, a little more creative. You know, we're the ones who kind of have the vision for the new technology, and we, you know, we're the founders of it. And then a place like SpaceX more takes over the technology and perfects it and makes it a kind of a, you know, like a process. And so I would say that's sort of how the difference between JPL and other aerospace companies is. We're kind of the visionaries. We're the ones who come up with it, to do the science, and then we may develop technology, but then we hand it over to another company who does a better job at perfecting it and making it operational. I'd say that's sort of the difference.
I asked you a while ago about why we should be spending money on space program. As a Christian, one of my favorite topics to talk about that the church doesn't talk about a whole lot is the subject of beauty and the believer.
Yeah. Yes.
And I would think, if I were in your position, you tell me what you think of it, but being able to appreciate the beauty of God's amazing universe from a perspective that you can't get on Earth would be a real appeal. Can you talk on how you think about beauty in what you do?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great comment, Ross. Beauty is everything. I mean, God is beautiful, right? When we read scripture and we read about his characteristics and, you know, unchanging, all loving, I mean, that's beautiful. And his creation is beautiful. You know, I think out of the pictures I had, I would say this one is the most beautiful. I mean, look at this, a black hole. I mean, it's a scary thing, right? It's something that swallows up matter, and it's just, but it's so amazing, you know, that the research we've been doing on it recently and how useful it is. And it shows us that there's a God, right? Hughes paper. It's a useful tool. It gives us a radio reference point so we can land on Mars on a dime. I mean, God has made it for us for multiple purposes. It's an incredibly interesting subject. What's inside a black hole? What's in there, you know? I read something about black holes. The space inside is actually could be thought of as larger than the outside. You know, you think of Doctor Who and the TARDIS, it's sort of related to that. You know, it's just fascinating, and obviously the real physics isn't anything like the science fiction, but it's a fascinating subject. It's beautiful, it's amazing, and, you know, that's why we're here, right? I mean, I'm a musician, I love beautiful music, I play music, and I love hearing it, and it's just, that's kind of what makes life worth living, right? It's beauty. That's one, love is beautiful, you know, and so that's tremendously important to our faith and to our reason to believe.
I think, yeah, let's give him applause for that. Personally, I think if the evolutionary paradigm were true, we wouldn't care at all about beauty. It would not be a thing.
Yeah, that's the logical, I think, you know, kind of the naturalistic viewpoint. I think even the hardest atheists I talk to, they agree there's beauty, and they kind of they're borrowing, you know, from us, from the theistic viewpoint, I think. And if they were completely logical about it, they wouldn't appreciate beauty. Why? What's the point? You know, at least that's my viewpoint. Of course, if I debated them, they'd probably tear me to pieces. So it's not all that easy, you know, but that's the ongoing battle, right? Is that we think beauty matters and they may not.
Hi, Steve. I'd like to return a little bit to the idea of man's going to Mars or places like that. And you've talked about the problems going there, and I think a lot of those problems are kind of well known, well known to us who aren't in the community, and yet we see leadership emphasizing these kinds of projects, establishing a community on the moon, for example, an indefinite community. The thing that comes to me is that some of these things, yes, we can agree that the search for technology and understanding and learning and knowledge is a great motivator. But with that in mind, the thought comes to me is that the importance of that, how important is that these other things, sending humans to Mars and establishing that community. And because to me, personally, I mean, we know that even if we send a man to Mars, what are the limitations then? So you send him to Mars, where's the next step? The next star? You know, I mean, so these things become such almost absurd thoughts. And because many of our leaders are actually pointing in that direction, seems I'd really kind of lose faith that they have faith in their direction in coming up with good programs. I mean, so I question the people want to pursue projects that really seem to, I mean, lead nowhere. For example, does the flight to Mars, does that lead any place? We can probably find out anything we want to know about Mars with our instrumented flights, and we're in the process of that. And so that, what more are we going to learn by, well, I don't know what more we're going to learn. Okay, but my point is that I lose confidence in the people who are presumably leading our space technological programs by their insistence on making excessive goals or setting excessive goals, excessively expensive, and goals that are likely not to get us any place. Anyway, so that my point is, yes, it seems to me that the leadership in that respect is lacking.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think one thing you got to realize is, you know, you can have visions and things you're going to do, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to happen. And I don't think there's anything wrong with aiming high. I mean, you know, this idea of boots on the ground on Mars is an interesting idea. If we can do it, we would do it. If it's possible, but if it's not possible, we're not going to do it. So it's sort of a self-correcting thing, I think. You know, but maybe there are some issues where, yeah, like for instance, they canceled the Mars sample return mission. You know, that's the point I make. It's like, if you're not willing to invest $10 billion to go to Mars and return samples with a robot, you're not going to be willing to do it with a human. It's going to cost 100 times the price. So that's my point. But I guess I don't want to be too much of a damper on enthusiasm, because in my view, any view outwards, any technology development, any vision towards that could be a good thing in the long run. So, I kind of have a nuanced view on it. I'm not against the man on Mars thing. I think, you know, as we focus on it and we realize how hard it is and how impossible it is, we'll change our priorities. But things in the interim, of course, you know, there's lots of ideas, and sometimes we can be frustrated with the direction they're going. Like, you know, layoffs at JPL, I'm not happy about that. They laid off a lot of good people who would have done the Mars sample return mission, and now they're gone, and there's no way to really get them back. You can't recover from that one. So, yeah, there's issues there that, you know, you can debate. But
one of the good reasons to continue the SETI project from a Christian standpoint is that probably year after year and decade after decade, they're not going to hear anything. And that's a statement in itself.
Right, that's a good point, Ross. Even in the SETI, you know, you can say, oh, that's a waste of money. But it's proving a point, right? That's what science is. You may want the result to be a certain thing, and you do it, and it tells you what the result is. And it may not be what you want, but it is a result, and it does tell you something. So in that sense, it's worthwhile.
I have one other comment online, and then I'll ask you to close in prayer, Steve. Turin, Canada says, please pass along to Dr. Hugh Ross how we enjoyed his excellent primer on Socrates in the City podcast last week. Eric Metaxas is certainly a fan. So Hugh, maybe next week you can tell us about that, how that went. And everybody, if you're not familiar with Socrates in the City, some fantastic episodes. Go on YouTube or wherever you like to go and look that stuff up. Steve, thank you. Thank you. This was great. Would you please close us in a word of prayer?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and thanks so much for having me. Father, we thank you for beauty. That's what you are, Lord. You're beautiful. Your creation is beautiful. Your love is beautiful. The people you made are beautiful. And Lord, when we're focused on you and your son, Jesus, that's what life is. It's beautiful. And Lord, we thank you for that. We thank you that you ultimately will take us into your beautiful kingdom. And we're so grateful for that. Lord, help us through this life, through our trials, through our times of doubt. Help us to keep our focus on you, like Peter had to keep his focus on Jesus when he walked out of the boat and sank when he didn't. And when we look at you, we don't sink. Even though it seems like the world is smarter and better than us, when we focus on your Son, Jesus Christ, Lord, you take us to great places. We thank you for this time, and we just dedicate it to you in Jesus' name. Amen.